Welcome to Eternal Life. Seven questions that every intelligent skeptic should ask about Jesus of Nazareth. This is a special free podcast series that is created for anyone who genuinely seeks truth, but who sometimes struggles to believe in some of the miraculous and supernatural elements of the Christian faith. This is a safe place where you can belong without having to believe, as we aim to objectively explore the logical, historical, and academic facts and circumstances that surround the life of Jesus, whom many call Christ. My name is Rory Baden, and I'm not a pastor or leader of any religious organization. I'm actually a researcher, a New York Times bestselling author, and a Hall of Fame business speaker who has spent a lifetime wrestling with these very questions in my own personal life. I've simply decided to share my findings here so that if I should die before my kids become old enough to understand this, that my two young sons would have documentation for the rational reasons why Daddy has come to believe in miracles, a resurrection, heaven, and the story of Jesus as Messiah. I'm glad you're here. Let's explore the evidence. Was Jesus of Nazareth a real person? Simple question, right? But I think an important question, both for believers of the Christian faith and for those who maybe are not believers of the Christian faith, because if there is no Jesus, then there is no Christianity, there is no heaven. And so we must first go, well, how do we even know that Jesus existed? And even if you are a believer, maybe you devoutly believe in the Christian faith, but I still would ask the question, how do you know? How do you know Jesus was real? And if you're talking to a friend or a family member who maybe was struggling with some of the things, and they would say, how do you know? I mean, it's something that we often automatically might take for granted as believers, but what evidence really is there? And do you have deep conviction in your own faith that there is structure and support for it? And so that's what we're going to look at here, is just exactly what proof is there of the existence of Jesus as a real person. And there's really three different types of corroboration that we're going to look at. So first of all is historical, which is going to basically be like documents. And you're going to look at what documents were written and when were they written and by whom were they written and what can we infer and what can we decipher and what can we conclude based on those documents about the probability or the likelihood that Jesus either lived and walked the earth or he did not. The second area that we're going to look at in terms of corroboration for whether or not Jesus was a real person is to archaeology, right? So archaeological, meaning physical discoveries. And are there or have there been physical discoveries that can point to and evidence and be used as evidence for the support that Jesus was a real person? And then the third one is prophetic, meaning what written predictions were there about this man, if any, and then what did they say? And then what reason or cause is there to believe that he actually satisfied those? So as I mentioned before, a lot of the historical references and research comes from The Case for Christ by Lee Strobel, this book, a really incredible book, very detailed, very thorough, a lot of citations. And so part of what I've done is I've gathered the information from that book, from a few other places, several other sources actually, and I have built some tables that I put together for myself, again, originally in my own journey, just to explore and better understand in a more concise fashion what evidence is there that Jesus really was a real person. So the first thing to do is I want to point out and look at what counts in terms of a historical context, what is necessary for us to have access to or to find preservation of, to sort of determine or conclude or come to the resolution that something actually happened in the past, right? Because that's a good question. You go, how do you prove that something happened even yesterday, right? And of course you would go, oh, well, we would have a picture of it. And that would be maybe a level of proof, but pictures could be manufactured. And you go, well, maybe a video would be more likely, but we go, okay, well, what time was the video taken? And of course, photography and video didn't exist hundreds of years ago and centuries before. So we go, all right, what are we going to look at? And in order to assist us on this part of the journey, what we're going to do is we're going to look at Christian related evidence, or let's call it Jesus evidence for Jesus. But then we're also going to look at other references, other historical references of things that have happened and things that have been written to go, okay, if what is the threshold and sort of the level of acceptance or the level of proof necessary or required to sort of come to the conclusion academically or historically speaking that something really did happen. Okay. So I'm going to walk you through this table, and there'll be a link somewhere that you can download these. If you want access to these tables, we'll make them available just so that you can look at them. So first of all, the first manuscript that I want to look at is the Annals of Imperial Rome. Okay. So this is part of Roman history. The author is Tacitus. The original publication date was 116 AD. And so this is written in Greek, and this is something that basically is one of the early manuscripts that we look at in terms of verifying the history of Rome. So the original publication date was 116 AD, and there's only been one copy, like one original copy that has ever been recovered, and it was recovered in 850 AD. So it was written in 116. This is documenting some of the history of Rome, the kind of history that we would all find to be true and we would find in history books. So it was written in 116, but it wasn't recovered until 850 AD. So there's 734 years between the original being written and a recovered copy of that original. So that's 734 years. And there's only one copy, like one early copy that we have found, right? That has been discovered. And yet most academics, historians would point to that and consider that as accurate and truthful and trustworthy and history of Rome. Another ancient text, this is another ancient manuscript, was written by Josephus. And this is, I think, again, apologize for the name pronunciation. I believe his full name is Titus Flavius Josephus. That's my attempt to explain it, who was born in the late AD 30s, right? So this is really around the time of Christ. This manuscript is called the Jewish War. And so he was born in AD 30, and he wrote it around 100 AD. So later in his life, he's 70 years old. And there are 9 copies that have been recovered of this manuscript. So the original one is written in 100 AD. 9 copies, early manuscript copies have been recovered. But the earliest one that was recovered was from 1100 AD. So 1,000 years passed between the one that was originally written and the one that we have a copy of, 1,000 years. But most academics, widely, it is held to be trustworthy because there's 9 different copies of that manuscript, and 9 copies of a document that old is apparently a very trustworthy number. Now, the Iliad, so this is the Iliad. If the Iliad is the Bible of ancient Greeks, and this is written by Homer, right? You've probably heard Homer's Iliad. So Homer's Iliad was originally written in 800 BC. So this is before Christ. So this is 800 years before Christ was born. This was also written in Greek. And there are 650 copies, early manuscript copies that have been recovered, which is a bunch, right? So that's why Homer's Iliad is widely accepted as very much as true and a reliable ancient manuscript. But the earliest recovered copy of a manuscript was recovered in 200 AD. So it is also 1,000 years past from when it was originally written to when we actually got a recovered version. But then since that time, there's been 650 copies that have been recovered. Okay. So those are just three reference points for you. Okay. If you are, you know, the historic mind, or, you know, if you're into ancient history, you'll recognize those authors and those manuscripts, and giving you a sense of the timeline there, right? So for one of them, there's one copy, another there's nine copies, another there's 650 copies, and anywhere between 730 to 1,000 years passed between the original written and the earliest manuscript that was recovered, a copy of a manuscript. So you got hundreds of years passing between the original being written and our first copy that we have in hand, all very much considered to be held as true. Now, if you look at the New Testament, so we look at the, now let's look at the Bible, right? Let's look at the foundation of Christianity, written by several different authors, so multiple people. The original publication date is around 50 AD, and we'll talk through this more specifically. Obviously, there's multiple books, multiple authors, so the question about when are they written all depends. Obviously, the Old Testament was written BC, but we're just looking at the New Testament here, because the New Testament is really what documents the life of Christ by eyewitnesses who were there and people who knew those eyewitnesses and the people who lived in that time. So the earliest publication date is around 50 AD, which Christ died around 30 to 33 AD. So within 20 years of his death, less than 20 years of his death, people started writing this down, which makes sense, right? Because if you go, well, if everybody suddenly, if something major happened and people started talking about it, and then they started asking questions about it, and everybody wanted to know, and word started to spread, people would have questions. And so at some point, someone would get tired of answering the same questions over and over again and go, we should just write this down so that we can send it to other people and so that we can transfer it and so that that knowledge can be distributed or disseminated in that fashion. So that timeline lines up with what is believed to have happened. So the original publication date is 50 AD, and there have been over 5,000 recovered copies of New Testament manuscripts. 5,000. And the earliest recovered portion of a manuscript is from 125 AD. So it was written in 50 AD. And we have a portion, a piece of the manuscript that was recovered in 125 AD. So only 75 years between the original being written and the first copy being recovered. And this is tremendously important. And let me tell you a little bit about this specific piece that was recovered, because you can actually go look at this. So this is, it's five verses from John 18. And this document today lives in the John Rylands Library in Manchester, England. So it was discovered in 1934 by a British scholar, C.H. Roberts, who was examining these old papyrus fragments that were like uncatalogued. And so he's just like going through them. And so this fragment that came from Egypt, and this is, that's also a really important fact, because you go, okay, this is a copy of an original and it was in Egypt. So that means that the gospel itself must have been written much earlier, because it would have had to be written by John in and around Galilee and Nazareth and this whole area of Jesus's life. And then what happens is that copy had been spread around and passed, and it had made its way all the way to Egypt by 125 AD. So in that 75-year period, it was already starting to spread. And so everyone agrees that this was a copy, not an original, which is what all of these are. These are copies, but this is the oldest copy of an original that we have. So the original likely would have been written multiple decades earlier in order to have been written, copied, and handed from one community to the next, and sort of for it to propagate and pass across the continent and then finally be buried in Egypt, where it then sat for hundreds, over 1,000 years. And then it was discovered in 1934, or it was discovered earlier than that, but then we didn't realize what it was until 1934. But it's really significant because it tells several parts of the story here, just to like break this down for you. So first of all, there are way more copies of New Testament manuscripts than any other ancient manuscript. by way more, right? So you're talking about 10, almost 10 times more than the next one, which is Homer's Iliad. So you've got lots and lots and lots of copies to corroborate and verify and calculate and make sure that there is a consistent story that is being told here, that at least many of the major, major facts are true, or they at least line up with one another. So you've got thousands of copies. But not only are there thousands of copies, the other important point here is the amount of time that has passed between when the original was written and when the earliest version that we have is. Why? The reason this matters is because of legend, right? Legends develop. And if you know any fishermen, or if you know any golfers in your life, maybe you've had this experience where there's this legend of the first time they tell the story, they caught a fish and it was 8 inches. And then the next time they tell the story, it was 12 inches. And 30 years later, when grandpa's sitting by the fire telling the grandkids the story, he's telling a story about how he caught a 38-inch fish out of the pond down the road. And that's what happens with legend, right? And so that's one of the things that historically we have to guard against, is this sort of exaggeration over time, is I guess how I would maybe sort of, I would define legend at least here, is exaggeration over time. Well, if Christ died between 30 and 33 AD in that range, and the first version is written in 50 AD, that's not even 20 years that have passed. That's not much time for legend to develop, for the facts to be skewed, at least nowhere near some of these other ancient manuscripts that are held up and as true and widely accepted as true. But not only that, the time between the original and the one that we've recovered is 75 years. And that matters just to make sure that the copy is close to what the original was, right? So over time, there's a chance that as things get copied, they get miscopied. And so it's not so much legend as it is error that starts to take place and settle in. But here we're talking about versions of the New Testament that are within 75 years of the original, which is within 20 years of the actual event, compared to other ancient manuscripts of history that had hundreds and hundreds of years that passed before we ever recovered a copy of what was originally written. And we only have a very small number of copies, in some case, one or nine or a few hundred, but nowhere near the 5,000 that speak to the New Testament. So historically speaking, there is a lot of corroborating documented evidence of the New Testament, just meaning the more copies there are of something and the earlier those copies are recovered, the more likely we can believe that it is true. And compared to other things that we cite as history, there's far, far more historical evidence. Now, this is something that is just really, really powerful and important to overlook. Now, that what I cited here at that's the piece from John 18, five verses from John 18 that are in the John Rylands Library in Manchester, England, that's just one small portion of the Bible. But the complete New Testament, well, let me read you a couple of these, okay? So there are large, so that's 125 AD. So that's our earliest recovery of a manuscript from the New Testament. But there's large portions of 8 of the letters of Paul in Hebrews, so those are books in the New Testament, that were recovered, that were written in 200 AD, okay? So a little bit longer, but still within a couple hundred years here. Two-thirds of the Gospel of John, there is a copy of that that was from 200 AD. So we have that. That's a very early discovery. Portions of the four Gospels and the book of Acts were recovered from a copy that was written in 300 AD. And then this, to me, there's by 300 AD, you've got letters from Paul and Hebrews, two-thirds of the Gospel of John, portions from all four Gospels and the book of Acts, large portions of Luke and John in other completely separate discovery, sizable sections of Revelations, which is a book that is written by John. We'll talk about that in a second, all by 300 AD. And by 350 AD, we have a complete, intact New Testament. So that is in less than 300 years, or I guess not less, approximately 300 years after Jesus dies, There is a completely full, intact copy of the entire New Testament that has been recovered, right? So that's the entire thing. And again, it's far, far less than half of the time that has passed with some of these other historical documents. So those are the discoveries of the New Testament, okay? And the New Testament, or those are biblical corroborations, meaning they're pieces of the Bible that have been found. But one of the parts that was also very compelling to me about the story of Jesus, and just honestly getting myself to come around to the idea, was like, how do we even know this was a real person? Is that there is a large amount of historical documentation about Jesus that was written by people who did not write books of the Bible, right? So what that means is there are outside parties, completely uninterested parties, unbiased parties, completely objective, people who were not documenting Jesus's life for the purpose of documenting what happened, or for the purpose of maybe communicating or translating or expressing what they saw as part of telling the story of why they believe that he is the Messiah and the Christ. But separate of all of those, there are other outside, unrelated, completely third-party manuscripts that reference the life of Jesus. So let's walk through some of those. Again, apologize for some of the pronunciations. I'm sure some of these are going to be a little bit weird. Okay, so the first one is the history of the Eastern Mediterranean world since the Trojan War. The author is Thales, and this was written in 52 AD. So originally written in 52 AD. Although the original manuscript has never been recovered, Julius Africanus quotes it in 221 AD, referencing a day the earth went dark. Thales claimed it was an eclipse, but Africanus argues that it could have been at the date of the crucifixion. So this just means there is a discussion happening about a day that the earth went dark. And that matters because that concept is referenced in the Bible, okay, by the people who were there, as something that happened, that the earth went dark. And so here you have another completely outside, separate set of authors discussing when that happened and why it happened. But what's interesting about that is they're agreeing that it did happen. So they're disagreeing about when it happened. So it doesn't necessarily say, oh, this is a third-party validation that the earth went dark the day that Jesus was crucified, which is what the Bible says happened. But there is agreement that at some point, loosely in and roughly around that time, there was a day that the earth went dark, and multiple people that were non-biblical writers agree upon that and are discussing when it was and sort of why it happened. So that's an interesting reference. Then there is a manuscript called the Antiquities. This was also written by Josephus. This is written in 93 AD, and it refers to James, the brother of Jesus. So there's a couple Jameses. There's James that's a disciple and that's close to Jesus in his life. And then there's James, the brother of Jesus, who you'll learn later. James, the brother of Jesus, didn't actually believe his brother Jesus was the Messiah until after he died, when he saw the resurrected Christ. But anyways, this manuscript refers to James, the brother of Jesus, and also to Jesus himself. It mentions the high priest Ananias having James, the brother of a man named Jesus, who was called Christ, to be stoned to death. So this is referring to a historical event, which is that there was a person named Jesus. He had a brother. Jesus was referred to, as many people, by the Christ. He had a brother named James, and James eventually was stoned to death. This is important because Josephus is a widely regarded historian. So his accounts of the Jewish War have proven highly accurate and have been corroborated by archaeological excavations at Masada, as well as by historians like Tacitus. So Josephus is a non-biblical writer who is widely kind of accepted by both believers that are historians and non-believers, like non-Christians, but they all sort of agree that, okay, Josephus had very accurate accounts of the Jewish War, and that's been validated by archaeological excavations. And he's the person writing this, talking about James, the brother of Jesus, called Christ, is stoned to death. So that is a really good piece of, and that's in 93 AD. So that's within one lifetime of somebody who would have lived when James and Jesus were both alive. Then there's a manuscript that was written by someone called Pliny the Younger. And this is a piece of personal correspondence, apparently, between Pliny the Younger and his friend, Emperor Trajan. And this is written in 111 AD. And this refers to him punishing Christians for their stubborn belief worship of Christ as God. It also references that Christians had self-imposed high ethical standards. So again, this is secular or non-Christian. This is a secular corroboration of a group of people called Christians that are worshiping a man named Christ, believing that he was God and that they had these high ethical standards. Then Tacitus in 115 AD, he wrote something that refers to the fact that Nero persecuted Christians, that a man called Christ was crucified during the reign of Tiberius by Pontius Pilate, and that, quote, an immense multitude held so strongly to their beliefs that they were willing to die rather than recant. We'll talk about this later on when we talk about the resurrection, but this was an issue because Romans had many, many gods, and then Christians are coming along saying, no, Jesus is the God. He is the only one. He is the way. And so it kind of creates conflict, right? When somebody says, no, this is it. You all are wrong. And so Romans were in power at the time. And so Nero was killing Christians. And that's documented, which is important. These secular manuscripts are important because they at least validate some of the historical events that are going on, which help corroborate what is actually in the Bible. So then there's a Greek author from Caria who is writing a chronology. I believe you pronounce his name Phlegon or Phlegon. I don't know. Sorry. But it's Phlegon. And this is written in 137 AD. And Phlegon reports that in the fourth year of the 202nd Olympiad, which is 33 AD, okay, that there was the, quote, greatest eclipse of the sun, and that, quote, it became night in the sixth hour of the day, which was noon, around noon, so that stars appeared in the heavens, and there was a great earthquake in Bithynia, and things overturned in Nicaea. So here's another reference from somebody that is within one generation of the time of Christ. So this is happening in 137 AD, referring back to a date in 33 AD where there is this great eclipse. This is, again, significant because this isn't referring to the deity of Christ. That's not the discussion. This is referencing something that happened in the physical world. The earth was dark, and people who were non-believers, not only people who were non-believers, but people who didn't even know Jesus or didn't know the story of Jesus or didn't know who Jesus was or claimed to be, they don't have to know anything about Jesus to know that the sky went dark. And that is important because it's referencing this event that happened that has now been corroborated by multiple people, which corroborates very closely, if not precisely, to the same event that is documented in the Bible or referenced in the Bible the day that Jesus dies. So that's interesting. And then there's the Talmud, which is a very important Jewish document. In 500 AD, it mentions Jesus as a false Messiah who practiced magic and was put to death. They repeat a rumor that Jesus was born of a Roman soldier and Mary, not the Virgin Mary, which is what the Bible says. That's the Christian belief. And what the Bible says is that Jesus was born of a virgin, the Virgin Mary. But the Talmud here, apparently, which is written in 500 AD, is advancing an opposing story, which is that a Roman soldier got Mary pregnant. And so why is this important? Well, at first, when I heard this or discovered this, at first, it kind of seemed to disprove or challenge the Christian story, which is, this is a very contradictory story here, which is that Jesus is born of a Virgin Mary, and that's the Christian belief. And so here you have this other document that is diametrically opposing that narrative. But even though it's diametrically opposing in some ways, some key elements, primarily, how did Mary get pregnant? For which, by the way, is understandable to me to go, if you don't believe in the divine, like if you don't believe in the Christian story and you don't believe in the divine, you go, how could Mary get pregnant without somebody impregnating her? And if that's what you believe, then you would then go, well, there's got to be an explanation. Someone had to get her pregnant, right? So it takes a bit of faith to believe in the Christian version that says God sent the Spirit into Mary and impregnated her with the Son of God, Jesus Christ. So it does make sense that if people, it makes sense to me that back in the day, in that time, there would be people that who believed and people who didn't believe, just like there are now, right? There's people who believe and there's people who didn't believe. Well, if there was a group of people who didn't believe, which presumably there would be, they would be searching for an alternative explanation to the story of this man, Jesus, to go, well, we don't accept the explanation that he was born of a virgin. And so there is some other story that I guess maybe could be true, right? So if you're not yet believing Christian, you go, maybe this is true, that a Roman soldier impregnated Mary. But what's interesting about it is it, first of all, it mentions Jesus. So it corroborates again that Jesus was a real person. It also mentions Mary. So that corroborates another fact that Mary is his mother. Now, it contests the idea of how Mary became pregnant, which it offers the alternative explanation that it was from a Roman soldier and not from the Holy Spirit of God. But even though it is an alternative explanation, it still does corroborate the idea that something unusual happened around Jesus's birth, right? Because there's this unnamed, unknown Roman soldier that is referenced as an explanation for where this Jesus person really came from. So again, it sort of, even though it opposes the Christian or biblical viewpoint, it actually corroborates several important details and it corroborates the existence of Jesus, which is really what we're talking about here.
Thank you for listening to this special podcast series, Eternal Life, 7 Questions Every Intelligent Skeptic Should Ask About Jesus of Nazareth. Hopefully, you'll notice that I've tried to take great care in documenting and citing references so that you can go explore the sources yourself. If you would like a consolidated copy of all of these citations, including an organized listing of all of the Bible verses that I referenced throughout the whole series, please visit eternallifepodcast.com/free, and I'll send it to you. Again, to grab that free resource, just head over to eternallifepodcast.com/free. Enjoy.
So there is one scholar, Gary Habermas, who many people seem to refer to, and he wrote a book called The Verdict of History. And Gary is a scholar. I am not a scholar in this area. Again, I am a layman here, trying to share with you my interpretation of my discovery of my road here, of how I've come to challenge and answer and resolve some of these questions. But Gary is an actual scholar. He wrote a book called The Verdict of History, and he references that there are 39 ancient sources that document or refer to the life of Jesus. Okay, so there's 39 that we have found. But here's what's fascinating. 7 of those 39 are secular. So they're not written by believers and people of the Bible and eyewitnesses. They're written by other people. So together, these 39 sources, they verify over 100 facts about Jesus's life, his teachings, his crucifixion, and his resurrection. Several of those that are prophecies are written in the Old Testament were written hundreds of years before they came true, right? So some of these ancient sources are in the Old Testament, and so they're in the Bible, and they're referencing the coming Messiah, and we'll look at prophecy later in the series, and we'll talk about that. But 24 of these 39 ancient sources, 7 of which are secular, okay? So 24 of these 39 ancient sources, 7 of which are secular, reference somehow the divine, mystical, or miraculous nature of this man, Jesus. So they don't all say Jesus is the Son of God and we all believe that he is the Messiah. Okay. But 24 of the 39 make some reference to the fact that there was something highly unusual about this man. Whether you believe he's the Christ or the Son of God is sort of like up for debate still. But it's important that there are all of these ancient sources that are commenting, providing commentary on the fact that this man, Jesus, did unusual things, and seven of those being secular. So that's really important. So that's some of the historical corroboration around the documentation for the life of Jesus. Now, we're going to go back. We'll dive deeper here in the Gospels in a second to talk about who wrote them. But I want to move on for just a brief moment to the archaeological verification and archaeological corroboration. Now, one thing you got to know beforehand is that archaeology cannot prove spiritual truths, right? So if the Bible says that Jericho was in a certain place and archaeology verifies that fact, that doesn't prove that everything in the Bible is true. It just proves that Jericho is a real place and it is where the Bible said it was. It doesn't prove that Jesus is the Son of God or that he rose from the dead. But what it does do is it means that the Bible is more trustworthy in general. And so you can't ignore it, because what it is saying or what it advances is that the Bible is historically accurate, or that in this case, it is archaeologically accurate. If it were fiction, it would say a bunch of things that were not true and therefore could be proven to be untrue, which would therefore point to a conclusion that the Bible, or at least the New Testament, was not accurate. It wasn't a documentation of something that happened. It was manufactured. It was made up. It was creative. It was imaginative, because you couldn't verify the facts. So what is fascinating about archaeology, I just want to be as forward and clear about this, is that of everything that I've looked at, of the scholars that I've studied, of the research, the findings that exist, archaeology has never once proven the Bible false. Not once. Not a single time. Now, there are some things that have been said in the Bible that archaeology has not yet supported, but it's never proven it false. So you understand the difference, right? And that this is an important distinction to just be clear, again, trying to just have as much of an objective look here as possible, is to go, okay, Jericho, the Bible talks about Jericho, and Jericho, it says there's a place called Jericho and it's in this certain location. And then years later, archaeologists come and they dig and they discover, oh, there is a place called Jericho and it is in that location. Doesn't mean Jesus is the Son of God. Doesn't mean that he rose from the dead. Doesn't mean that heaven is real. But it does mean that Jericho is where the Bible says it is, which means that the facts in the Bible can be trusted. And the more facts that are verified, the more trustworthy it becomes from a scholarly perspective, from a historical perspective. And so that is amazing. That blows my mind to go, in all the hundreds and now, you know, almost 2,000 years that have passed since the death of Jesus of Nazareth, and all of the people who would have wanted to disprove it and had reasons to disprove it and just didn't like the story of Jesus for whatever reason, nobody ever has been able to furnish an archaeological discovery that disproves something in the Bible as inaccurate. Now, I'm going to roll through a few of these examples on the topic of archaeology, okay? So just as I mentioned this, so you can be just a little bit in awe of how much real world, practical, pragmatic, historical evidence there is here for some of this stuff. So Luke, who is the author of the Gospel of Luke, and he's also believed to be, many people believe, the writer of Acts. Luke, who was a doctor, well, again, we'll talk about him in just a second. He has been proven right by archaeology in regards to 32 references to countries, 54 cities, and 9 islands. So that means that Luke has made almost 100, 95 to be exact. Luke has made 95 different geographical references, which have all been supported and verified by archaeology. Again, can't draw the conclusion that means Jesus is Christ, but we can draw the conclusion that Luke was a very accurate historian, that Luke was specific and deliberate and intentional about minor details, and that it points to the validity of the process of assembling the Bible in terms of how the Bible was assembled and the rigor that was applied into screening out which parts of the Bible, which books of the Bible got accepted in and what was not allowed in and what was canonized. That's another churchy term. Canonized means it was became part of the canonical Bible, like with the Bible as it exists today, right? But not all parts, not every ancient manuscript of the time was brought into the New Testament, right? So there's some criteria. One of the criteria apparently was that it had to be historically accurate. And so the Gospel of Luke specifically is really important because it's got 95 references which have been verified by archaeology. So Luke writes like 25% of the New Testament, and he was scrupulous. And both Christian believers and non-Christian believers, but who are scholars and historians, agree that Luke was accurate in his recount or account of the details surrounding the history of Jesus. They don't all believe that Jesus was the Son of God, but they believe that Luke was accurate in the details that are more verifiable, right? Like geographic locations. So here's another one. So John, who is the author of the Gospel of John, I'll introduce you to John here in a second. But John wrote the Gospel of John, and John was part of Jesus's inner circle, meaning like one of his, Jesus had like three on his inner circle, and John is one of them. So he is, if Jesus had a best friend, it would be one of his inner three. It would either be Peter, James, or John. But John was one of Jesus's inner three, and John wrote, the person John is also the author of the Gospel of John, which is one of the Gospels, meaning one of the recounts of the eyewitness testimonies of Jesus's life. He's also the author of 1 John, 2 John, and 3 John, and the book of Revelation. Okay, so in the New Testament, John, who we're talking about here, is the author of five books. Now, he mentions in his gospel that near the Pool of Bethesda, there are five porches. And this is fascinating because for years, archaeologists believed that John was wrong because no such place had ever been discovered. So like that seemed to, it was one of those things where it was like archaeology hadn't disproven John, but it also hadn't proven John to be true. And so the sort of general consensus was that John was referencing a fact about these five porches at the Pool of Bethesda that couldn't be verified. And it felt like that was a fact that should have been able to be verified because it was a very specific fact. But then recently, 40 feet underground, five porches were discovered. So this is a more recent discovery. And so John, a separate gospel writer, part of Jesus's inner circle, also recently proved on a very major and specific and explicit historical or geographical or archaeological fact or data point was proven accurate. So all in, there are 25,000 locations that show a connection with the Old Testament that have been located in the lands of the Bible. 25,000 locations. Again, none of that verifies that Jesus is the Son of God, but it points to, in a very academic way, in a scholarly way, in a logical way, in a common sense way, that the people who were writing were not making things up. They weren't willy-nilly frivolous and loose with their facts and details. They were, because there's no reason to be. They weren't writing fiction. They weren't imagining things. You don't have to believe what they were saying, but they believed what they were saying. And they were writing what they saw, and they were writing what was true. Like some of the part about Jesus being the Son of God is still debatable, right? But there were things that they were writing that are 100% verified as facts. And that is really important. So that is part of the archaeological corroboration. and never has archaeology disproved the Bible. That's really important. Now, the third type of corroboration that I mentioned is prophetic corroboration. I'm actually just going to table that one for a minute. We'll come back to that later. That's sort of like a whole separate can of worms. And honestly, it's, as I mentioned before, it's a little bit hard. That one is a little bit hard for me to believe. That was like, there were these ancient predictions of a coming Messiah. And the word prophecy is one of those churchy terms that just kind of like weirded me out for a long time. So we're going to just table that one and we'll circle back around to that later. Let's look now at who wrote the Gospels specifically. So you remember the Gospels are in the New Testament. So the Bible's divided Old Testament, New Testament. New Testament's about the back third of the Bible. And the first four books in the New Testament are the Gospels. They weren't really books. The authors never intended to write books. It wasn't like Rory Vaden. I am an author, right? I sit down to write books. These people were not going, let's write a book about Jesus. What they were doing was documenting what happened. They were documenting what Jesus said, and they were documenting what they saw. And the reason they were documenting it is because after Jesus's alleged resurrection, everybody in the world that was around there started asking questions, some because they were starting to believe, some because they were trying to disprove and make people unbelieve. But there was a lot of conversation, as you might imagine, if a bunch of people saw a dead man walking. So the Gospels are important, though, specifically because they're eyewitness accounts, they're eyewitness testimonies, meaning they're firsthand accounts or secondhand accounts. So let's look at these four. They're not all actually firsthand accounts, which you may not realize. And again, this is another one of those things where you may be listening. You may have been a Christian for years and not known some of this because I didn't. Okay. So first of all, the first gospel is Matthew, which is the first book in the New Testament. So who is Matthew? Matthew is a tax collector in a place called Capernaum. So that area of the world, okay, at this time in history is ruled by Rome. So it's the Roman Empire. So the Roman Empire is in charge. They're in control, right? So like that's the government. That's the political power. It's the war power. It's the Roman Empire system. So that is important in order to understand a lot of the stories of what's happening and what's documented or what is said to have happened. You got to sort of understand what's going on in the world, right? It's like if you were going to tell the life of Rory Vaden, it's relevant to know that Rory was born and lived in America. And because of that, I've had certain privileges like being able to start my own business, which is what has led me to be able to accumulate a level of money and wealth that I didn't grow up with. I was raised by a single mom. I was born in a trailer. I lived in a trailer park in Colorado, in Boulder, Colorado. And I spent a lot of my time as a young kid, we moved around to a lot of apartments because we didn't have money. And so as rents would increase, we would have to go somewhere else. And so we moved all the time. So I went to many different schools. That's part of how I learned quickly to be comfortable with new environments and became comfortable meeting strangers, which probably is part of what led me to become a professional speaker in my life, because I am comfortable standing and meeting lots and lots of new people because that was my childhood. I went to like 14 different schools before I was out of elementary school, right? So knowing my story and knowing the context of what is happening around my life, that my mom was poor, that I lived in Colorado, I went to all of these different schools, gives you insight into understanding who I am in my life and how I became to be who I am. Same is true about Jesus and any historical figure, right? Is the more you know about the historical context, the clearer this and the more accurate the portrayal becomes. So anyways, under the Roman Empire, okay, so under this system, the way that it worked is Matthew would have paid all the taxes in advance, and then he went and collected the taxes from the citizens and from travelers in Capernaum to reimburse himself. And tax collectors were hated people at the time. They were notoriously corrupt. The reason is because the tax collectors were protected by the Roman Empire because they were operating on, it's like the IRS, right? So the parallel today is think about the IRS, right? The IRS is collecting money and nobody particularly likes the IRS. We don't like to get letters from them. We don't like to pay them, but like you have to deal with them. And it's not like you could just like burn the IRS down because they're protected by the military power I'm using an American reference here, so apologies for that if you're outside of the United States, but that is our taxing entity, and they're protected by the power, including the military power, of the United States government. So even if I don't like the IRS, I have to sort of deal with them. Well, hopefully the IRS is more ethical today, and they've got laws that they have to abide by. But back in the time of Jesus, in the time of Matthew, in the time of the Roman Empire, it was basically Matthew's word. It was whoever the tax collector was. So they could pay the government and say, I'm the IRS, I'm going to pay the government $1 million. But then they could go charge all the citizens $10 million, and then they would pocket the difference, right? So tax collectors were hated by the people. And this is an important fact. To me, this is important. On the one hand, you know, you would go, well, does that discredit Matthew as a witness? Because, you know, people hated him. Well, I actually came to the conclusion that it was the opposite. Because if someone were to manufacture the Gospels, if someone were to fake the Gospels, if someone were to write a fiction story about the life of Jesus, you would not have chosen a tax collector to be one of the main contributors because everyone hated him. Right? It's kind of like you wouldn't choose somebody who everyone hated at that time to be a part of the source of truth of the story. That actually is edifying to me because I go, yeah, to me, the fact that Matthew is one of the writers points to that this was not assembled strategically by a bunch of people who made up a story. The more obvious truth and the more likely truth is that Matthew was there and he was writing what he saw. And what's amazing about that is Matthew was a very accurate record keeper, which makes sense because he's a tax collector, right? If you're the IRS, you have to be a good record keeper. So Matthew was a very accurate record keeper. And so that is important because he documents accurately several facts about what's happening in and around Jesus's life and ultimately what became Jesus's ministry when he's preaching and performing miracles, allegedly. So a tax collector, on the one hand, wouldn't be a very unlikely candidate that you would choose if you were going to manufacture the story, but it actually plays out well because of the personality type of Matthew being a record keeper. So Matthew's father, we know from Mark chapter 2, verse 14, that Matthew's father was a gentleman named Alphaeus, and that Matthew's original name was Levi. He was called Levi before Jesus meets him. And Jesus does this thing where he meets people and then he changes their name. And I think he does that. It's like a change of identity. And that's if you come to believe in this, the evidence for the story of Jesus, part of what you will be believing in is that because of Jesus, your identity is new. That as you accept Jesus into your life and as you conclude that the evidence of Jesus being who he said he was is true, if you come to that conclusion, part of the corresponding and the companion conclusion there is that you are made new. You are something new. You are different than who you were before. You were a sinner, and now you are made perfect because you are covered by the love, and more specifically, the blood of Jesus, that Jesus is the sacrifice for you. And so Jesus had this thing where he would give people new names, and he did that with Matthew. Matthew used to be Levi, and then he's called Matthatias, which it means the gift of Yahweh. So in those days, but it's been shortened to Matthew. So Matthew is one of the apostles, or one of the disciples, which are churchy terms for Jesus's homies, right? Like that's how I think about it. Again, I don't mean to be like sacrilegious. Please, I'm not trying to be sacrilegious. I'm just trying to make parallels to non-churchy people here, like me, where it's like, what, you know, these weird words like apostles, like what does that even mean? Apostles, disciples, those are basically Jesus's homies. His, you know, it's like his posse, his best friends, the people who were, he hung out with all the time. And, you know, there's 12 of them and Matthew was one of them. So Matthew, what that means is Matthew was an eyewitness to Jesus's life and death. So he's not telling you a third person story. He's recording, at least allegedly or proposedly, he is recording what he saw with his own eyes and what he heard with his own ears as he lived and breathed and walked and traveled and ate and slept near and around Jesus, right? So that's important. The other thing to know about Matthew is that ultimately he was murdered. Matthew, like many of the disciples, they died really gruesome deaths for what they believed. So Matthew is believed to have been martyred with something called a halberd, which apparently is like a, it's kind of like a combination of a spear and a battle axe. And this is according to the Anchor Yale Bible Dictionary, volume 4, page 643, the Anchor Yale Bible Dictionary says that Matthew was killed in a city called Nabadar. Again, this is where, please extend me some forgiveness on these terms. I haven't spent much time focusing on pronunciation. I've been more focused on just understanding the facts, right? But anyways, Matthew was martyred, and martyred is a churchy term for he was murdered for believing that Jesus was Christ. So ultimately, Matthew died. Sounds like a pretty vicious death because of what he believed. So he believed all the way until the day he died. He started out as this hated, greedy tax collector and then turned over this transformation over the course of being around Jesus and after Jesus into someone who believed all the way to a vicious death that Jesus was who he said he was. So that's Matthew. And Matthew wrote the first gospel. Then there is Mark, which is the second gospel. Mark was written by John Mark, who is sometimes historically referred to as Mark the Evangelist. Now, here's something important. A lot of Christians get confused on this. I got confused on this. Mark was not a disciple. Okay. So Mark is not somebody who was part of Jesus's homies, right? He's not in the tight group. And Jesus had like his 12 homies, which are like the disciples, the apostles. And then he had his inner circle, which was three people. But Jesus's inner circle, okay, so he has his 12 homies and then his inner circle. In Jesus's inner circle, there's three people. So one of them is Peter, originally called Simon, and then he's more commonly known as the Apostle Peter. That's another name change that I'm pretty sure that Jesus does. Jesus starts to call him Peter, later says that the church will, that it's for the rock, and he'll be the rock that Jesus's church is built on. But Peter is Simon. Early on, he's Simon, and then Jesus renames, he's called Peter, and then he's called Peter throughout the rest of the New Testament. But so Mark is not writing an eyewitness account. What Mark is doing is Mark is documenting the teachings of Simon Peter, originally called Simon, more oftenly referred to as Peter. We'll call him Peter, for that's the Apostle Peter. So Peter was an eyewitness to Jesus's life. Not only was Peter an eyewitness to Jesus's life, Peter is on the inner circle. He's in the inner three. So he is arguably Jesus's best friend. If Jesus has a best friend, it's likely Peter or John. There's three on the inner circle, Peter, James, and John. But Peter arguably is Jesus's best friend, the living Jesus and the historical Jesus, his best friend. So when you read Mark, what I want you to think of is one thing that helped me was to go, when I read Mark, I'm not really reading Mark, I'm reading Peter. You'll notice there's not a gospel of Peter. The gospel of Peter really is the gospel of Mark. So Mark's account is not an eyewitness account. It's an eyewitness account of an eyewitness account, if that makes sense. I think it's important for you to understand what's really going on there, right? So when you read it, you're not reading first person, you're reading second person. When you read Matthew, Matthew is first person. Matthew was there. He is writing what he saw. When you read Mark, it's not first person, it's second person. But it's still an eyewitness to an eyewitness. So it's very, very close, right? It's kind of the example I used earlier about like my great grandma. I don't know my great grandma. I wasn't old enough to remember her, but my mom sure does, right? Because that was her grandma. So if my mom told me stories of my great grandma and I recorded them, that would be second person or second party testimony, which is probably still pretty reliable, right? I mean, my mom would have been there. So it's not like, you know, 50 people down the road and who knows if it's true. That's it. Anyways, so Peter is part of the inner circle. The other one I mentioned, the other two are James and John. By the way, just a side note on this, because it gets confusing. James, the apostle, or James, the disciple, or James, Jesus's homie, is not the same James as James, Jesus's brother. Okay, so the book of James, which anecdotally is my favorite book of the Bible. So the book of James, which comes later in the New Testament, the book of James is written by James, the half-brother of Jesus, right? So technically they had different fathers because Jesus's father was God, but James's father was Joseph, which was Jesus's earthly father, and they had the same mother, Mary. So technically James, the brother of Jesus, is technically the half-brother of Jesus. They had the same mom, different dads. But the book of James is written by James, the brother of Jesus, who didn't believe Jesus was the Messiah when Jesus was alive. He only believed that Jesus was the Messiah after Jesus died because he saw him. And that we'll talk about that later. So, but James, this James, who's on the inner circle, is James the son, he's often called James the Great or James the son of Zebedee. And so James and John are brothers. Okay, so there's three on Jesus's inner circle, Peter, James, and John. James and John, which are the sons of Zebedee, James and John are brothers. That's why they're the sons of Zebedee. So anyways, I just want to make that clarification because these characters, like keeping all these people straight is like high level for me. I get lost, right? You know, and it's like there's so many characters in the Bible and there's all these weird names and I start to get lost. So I just want to make sure you understand James on the inner circle is different from James, Jesus's brother, who writes the book of James later. Anyways, I digress. So let me return here back. We're talking about the Gospel of Mark. The Gospel of Mark is really, this is how I think about it in my mind. The Gospel of Mark, I really think about as the Gospel of Peter. Peter is really Jesus's best friend. So even though Mark isn't an eyewitness account, to me, it's one of the most important Gospels because Peter was so close to Jesus, arguably the closest living person that there ever was to Jesus was Peter. And Mark is capturing out of Peter's mouth the story of Jesus's life. So anyways, we also know from Colossians 4:10 that Mark or John Mark or Mark, who we call Mark, was the cousin of Barnabas. And we know from Acts 12:12 through 17 that Mark was the son of a widow, of a widowed woman named Mary. So that's not Mary, Jesus' mom. This is a different Mary. And it's recorded that the disciples actually met in this other Mary's home, not Mary, Jesus' mom, but this other Mary, Mary, Mark's mom, that it's actually recorded that the disciples met at some point in Mary's home. And many people actually believe that this her home may have been the site of the Last Supper. So if you've ever heard the story of the Last Supper, many people think that that happened in Mark's mom's home. Her name was Mary, but that's not Mary, Jesus's mom. It's a different Mary. That's Mary, Mark's mom. So anyways, that's a little bit about Mark. Now let's talk about Luke. Who is Luke? And the reason you got to know these people again is if we're going to accept the gospel, like if we're going to look at the Bible as a source of truth, we got to know, okay, who is this person? Like who was this person that is writing this that I'm banking my eternity here, potentially, one way or the other. Either you're going to say, I don't believe in it, or I do believe in it. Either way, this is important, right? Because we're banking our confident eternal life, or our decision about our confident eternity on these people. So who is Luke? Luke was not a disciple. So Luke is not an apostle. So Luke is not part of the inner circle, and he's not one of Jesus's homies. So who is Luke then? Well, first of all, what was Luke? Luke was a doctor. Luke is a physician. And that is important. Part of why is because many Bible scholars accept that Luke was very, very accurate, right? So I mentioned that earlier, that in the archaeology situation, that Luke made 95 different references, which have all been supported by archaeology, right? So that sort of makes sense because the guy was a doctor. He was an actual physician. So he would have been somebody who paid attention to details. He was intelligent. He was probably articulate. And Luke is believed. So Luke, it's sort of agreed upon that Luke was an accurate historian, both by Christians and non-Christians. Okay. So there's, you know, in the world of academics, these scholars, there are academics who have come to believe that Jesus is the Son of God. And there are academics who believe that have not come to believe. They've looked at the evidence as I'm presenting it here to you. And they've come to, so there's academics on both sides, but both sets of academics, believers and non-believers, they agree that Luke was a particularly careful and detailed historian who accounted for specifics. And it's probably because of this medical background. So in the opening lines of Luke, so in the Gospel of Luke, the book of Luke, the second book in the New Testament, in Luke chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, Luke actually starts his recount of the life of Jesus by stating what his goal is. So he actually states the purpose for why he's writing this document. And here's what he says. He says that his goal was that after having, quote, carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have taught. What does that mean? So what's going on here? What that means is when Luke sat down to write, he wasn't writing a gospel. He wasn't writing something that he thought would become a book. He wasn't writing something that he thought would one day be in the New Testament. What Luke was doing was gathering a set of corroborated historical facts and assimilating them, and he was putting them together in a presentation, in a written, distilled presentation for someone who he refers to as Theophilus, which in Greek means friend of God. Okay. We don't really know. I guess we don't really know if that's a name or what, but it means friend of God. So it's like a title. It's like good sir, right? It'd be like saying, it's nice to meet you, good sir, something like that. But Luke also in his gospel refers to Theophilus as most excellent. So he uses that phrase, most excellent. And we know historically from that phrase, most excellent, that was a phrase that was used as a title of respect, as a Roman title of respect. So you would call someone most excellent or most excellent if they were someone who had stature in the Roman kind of culture, right? Or the Roman Empire. So it's possible, and you could argue quite possible, that Luke is writing to a Roman official. He's writing, we don't know exactly who he's writing to, but we know because he says that the purpose of the writing is to put together an orderly account that has been quote unquote carefully investigated so that you, my good friend or most excellent friend of God, may know the certainty of the things that you have taught. Okay, so Luke is basically providing evidence. Honestly, it seems like what Luke is doing here for Theophilus is a little bit what I am doing for you right now. He has gone and gathered all of these things. He is not a pastor by trade, right? He hasn't been classically trained in theology or anything like that. He's got a different trade. In his case, he's a doctor. In my case, I'm a writer, right? And an entrepreneur. But he is consolidating facts that he's corroborated from various locations, and he is presenting it into an orderly account for his friend, never knowing that the world would see this one day. So that's kind of like somewhat similar to what I'm doing for you here now, right? As I'm pulling from different places to present to you an orderly distilled account of how I've reconciled these very tough questions for me about how can I logically believe that Jesus was the Son of God and that he was raised from the dead and that my eternal life comes through him. Even saying it out loud logically is like, wow, sometimes I can't even believe what I believe, but I believe it so wholeheartedly, both from a faith heart perspective and now also from a historical perspective as we're walking you through here. Okay, so Luke is not an eyewitness, but here's the thing I want you to remember. Luke was a very close friend of Paul's. So Luke went on missionary journeys with Paul. Now, we haven't met Paul yet because Paul is not one of the disciples. In fact, so Paul is a very important historical figure and a very important biblical figure. But what you need to know about Paul is that at the time that Jesus lived and shortly after Jesus died, Paul persecuted Christians, meaning he killed them, he imprisoned them, he tortured them. Paul believed Christians were sacrilegious. Paul was a Pharisee. Paul was an expert Jew. Like, a Pharisee is basically an expert on Jewish law. So he was a Jew and he spent his whole life studying Jewish law. And so Paul thought that people who believed in Christ were committing blasphemy. And so because of that, he killed Christians because he originally thought that they were committing blasphemy against his God, the Jewish God, the God of the Old Testament. Later, Paul has an encounter with the resurrected Jesus. And he becomes a believer suddenly. We'll talk about this later. And then after that moment, Paul flip-flops sides. Paul goes from a murderer of Christians to perhaps the most prominent person in the Christian faith other than Jesus, because he shares the Bible, or he shares the gospel. He's the one who spreads the gospel around the globe. So Paul is really important. And Luke is a close friend of Paul's. So when you think of the gospel of Luke, I want to have you also sort of think about it as the gospel of Paul, right? So just like we said, the gospel of Mark is really more like the gospel of Peter. The gospel of Luke is really kind of more like the gospel of Paul. That's sort of how I think about it and have made sense of it in my head. So it is not a first person eyewitness account. It's a second person account. And so he learned a lot of this. He was close to Paul. And then he also corroborated from several other sources of the day. Now, most Bible scholars attribute the book of Acts. Okay. So after the gospel, the first four books of the New Testament are the gospel. The fifth book is Acts, or Acts of the Apostles, which that book is also attributed by most scholars to having been written by Luke. So that makes up about 26% of the New Testament. So Luke is a very important writer, because 26% of the New Testament, that's a big old chunk of it. And so it really matters that he was so detailed and such a careful and scrupulous historian. A couple other things to know really quickly about Luke. So Luke was a Gentile. So here's another churchy term you probably hear, like Gentile. So what is Gentile? A Gentile means a non-Jewish person. Right. So in the Old Testament, the God is, he's having you community with Jewish people, God's people, Israel. These are these Jewish folks. The Jews believe in the Old Testament, and they're sort of the keepers of the Old Testament. And then so basically, when Jesus comes, the people who were non-Jewish people, they were referred to as Gentiles. So if you read that term or hear that term, that's what it means. Well, Luke is Gentile. So why is that important or interesting? Well, it's because Luke is probably the only Gentile writer of the New Testament. So that's sort of apropos, because the news of Jesus, right? If you come to believe in Christianity, the news of Jesus is that Jesus and the hope of Jesus and the hope of God and the hope of love and the hope of eternal life and all of the hope of forgiveness, everything that is found in believing in Jesus is available for all people. Jesus is available for all people, all genders, all colors, all ages, all races, all ethnicities, all sizes, like all educational levels, all, you know, socioeconomic levels. Jesus is available for everyone. And that's really important, because prior to Jesus, God and Jewish law was really for Jews and for Israel, for God's people. So it's interesting that 26% of the New Testament is written by someone who's not a Jewish person. They're not of the sort of old school faith, if you will. Now, Paul was Jewish. I mean, he was an, you know, I said earlier, like an expert Jewish person. He was a Pharisee. He was an expert in Jewish law. So even though he didn't believe in Jesus originally, he still was Jewish. And a lot of Jews didn't believe. I mean, Jewish people were primarily responsible for putting Jesus on the cross. So there were a lot of Jewish people who didn't believe that Jesus was the Messiah. namely the Pharisees, who were the ones that ultimately killed Jesus. So even though Jesus is the Messiah of the Jewish people and the Jewish sort of faith, this is how I understand it, right? I'm not an expert on Jewish faith, but on the Christian faith is going, the Jews had it right all along. They had the Old Testament. They had it right all along, but they didn't recognize Jesus as the Messiah. He wasn't what they were looking for. And they didn't, not all of them were on board with it. And ultimately they killed him. So they were the group that led to his ultimate crucifixion and death. But Luke was non-Jewish. So anyways, that's just sort of an interesting nuance, which I find fascinating. And then in Luke 3:21, so Luke chapter 3, verse 21, Luke provides a genealogy of Jesus that goes all the way back to Adam in the Garden of Eden. So that's fascinating that he took the time to trace back all the way through hundreds and thousands of years in human history to where Jesus was a descendant of Adam in the Garden of Eden. That's fascinating, right? It was like the world's first massive family tree. So when you first read it, you're like, what is all this? This is boring, right? It's just like this long list of so-and-so was the son of so-and-so, who was the son of so-and-so, who was born to so-and-so, who wed with so-and-so. Like, but what he's doing there is he is tracking, again, with detail, the documented, the history of the birth line of Jesus of Nazareth. So fascinating. So that's Luke, which is, you know, I kind of think of it as Luke as the Gospel of Paul, even though Paul wrote lots of books. Peter also wrote other books in the New Testament, but not one of the Gospels. And those make up the Synoptic Gospels. You remember there's four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but the first three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are the Synoptic Gospels. They're sort of the details, the documentation of Jesus's life. And so those are the three authors that we've talked about so far, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So now let's talk about John, who is the author of the fourth gospel. So who is John? John is one of Jesus's three on the inner circle. So John is not only one of Jesus's homies, he's in the inner circle. So you remember I said the three in Jesus's inner circle are Simon Peter, who is called Peter, of which the Gospel of Mark is sort of based a lot on Peter's eyewitness testimony. So there's Peter, and then there's James and John, the sons of Zebedee. James and John. And so John, this is James' brother, is an eyewitness account, right? So when John is writing, it's not only an eyewitness account, it is presumably the closest eyewitness account, because Matthew is an eyewitness account, but Matthew was one of Jesus' homies. He's one of the disciples, but he's not one of Jesus's inner three. John is one of Jesus's inner three. He was with Jesus in the most intimate moments of Jesus's life. And you can read about all of these very intimate moments. So John typically is thought to have written five books of the New Testament of the Bible, which I've mentioned: the Gospel of John, the epistles, which again are letters to the early church body of believers, which is those epistles are 1 John, 2 John, and 3 John. And then John wrote the book of Revelation, which is the last book of the New Testament and therefore the last book of the Bible. And John wrote the book of Revelation while he was on the island of Patmos, which is a small Greek island in the Aegean Sea. And John was exiled there around AD 95 by the Romans. So he wasn't murdered in the brutal way that some of these other disciples and apostles were murdered, but he was exiled to this island and then he wrote it there. So his gospel is not one of the synoptic gospels because it records different things than Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke all record several of the same instances. They're all a little bit different. Like, there's a lot of similarities though, because it's basically like three different recounts of the same, you know, the same thing that happened. But John records different things, and John saw different things because he was part of the inner circle. For example, you've probably heard of Jesus washing the feet, like washing the disciples' feet at the Last Supper. John is the only gospel that records that episode. The other thing that's interesting about John, and can be confusing if you don't know this, is that John, in the Gospel of John, refers to himself in the third person, right? So if you think about what's happening here, John is recounting stories of Jesus's life, of which he is a character in the story because he was there, but he doesn't use the word or the language I, He doesn't refer to himself in the first person. He refers to himself in the third person. And he uses this really interesting term, which means the one whom Jesus loved. So whenever you read the Gospel of John and he says, Jesus was with, we were all there and with the disciple whom Jesus loved, that you can insert John there. That's himself. And that's how he refers to himself. And we know that John was very intimately trusted by Jesus. One of the ways that we know that is because when Jesus dies at the cross, okay, so when he's crucified, Jesus, and this is recorded in a few, in John chapter 19, verses 25 through 27. When Jesus dies, right before he dies, he asks John to care for his mother, Mary, right? So, you know, there he is. The son is on the cross, you know, Mary's son. He's dying and he looks at the disciple whom Jesus loved, which is John. And he asks the disciple who Jesus loved, which is John. He asks John to take care of his mother, Mary. And you can read that in John 19, 25 through 27. So there's a little bit about who the writers of the gospel are. And it's important, right? Just to kind of, again, create context for you. At least it was important for me. Maybe you fast forwarded through this entire part. I don't know. But it's important for me to just understand like the reality of who these people are, not just these like nebulous spiritual characters of this Holy Spirit filled word, of which I have no idea if any of it is accurate, historically speaking. But it's like, you can see this is where it comes from. And so it's important to see how grounded the Christian faith is, right? Yes, it's faith. It requires belief. It requires believing in some things that are not seen. Perhaps you'll see as we walk through this, but it's deeply grounded in archaeology, history, evidence, documentation, or, you know, at least I believe a fair bit. And that's what I'm walking you through.
I'm so honored that you are here, and I really hope that this Eternal Life podcast series is helpful to you and your loved ones. On that note, can I ask a quick favor? If you feel like it's appropriate, would you mind leaving me a rating and review on whatever platform it is that you use to listen to this show? That really helps get the word out about this so that we can reach more people with this information. And it helps people decide if this is something they should really take the time to get into. Relatedly, I also want to encourage you to share this episode or this entire series with anyone who you think might enjoy it. Obviously, it's totally free, but it's our prayer that God would use this series to reach a lot of people. Because we know there's a lot of people out there who struggle with doubt and skepticism, and I know what that's like. And I also know what it's like to experience the deep peace and fulfillment that comes from having completed all of this research. So if you don't mind, just visit the main listing of this series in whatever app you're using to listen to it and leave us a rating and review, and then just hit the share button and send this out to anyone in your life who you think might benefit from it. Thanks so much.
So let's talk about when the Gospels were written and how do we kind of know the Gospels are trustworthy. And the reason that I'm focusing in on the Gospels here is not that the whole New Testament isn't important or valuable, that totally is. It's just that the Gospels specifically exist to document the life of Jesus. So they are specifically historical documents. Most of the other writing in the New Testament is sort of interpretations or applications of Jesus's life and Jesus's teachings being articulated for the believers, the church of the day, the body of believers who are all in different cities, which is why there's those letters, the epistles. But the Gospels are more of like a historical documentation of what happened. So we really want to scrutinize those and look at those. And when the Gospels are written is a really important story. So earlier I referenced there's pieces of this and that from all these different parts of the New Testament and 5,000 original copies of or early manuscript copies of the New Testament have been recovered, which is exponentially more than any other ancient manuscript of that time era. But part of the reliability of the story is how much time passes between when the story happened, like when the actual event took place, and when it's documented. Because the shorter the time span there, the less chance for legend to develop, right? If I tell my son, and then my son tells his son, and his son tells his son, and his son tells his son, and his son tells his son, and then before you know it, 1,000 years have gone by, and it's never been documented, it's not written, it's only translated through voice, the likelihood of inaccuracies is higher. So we have to look at when these are written. So the book of Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, most scholars think that this book was written around AD 70. So again, most historians believe that Jesus died at around AD 33. So that is less than 40 years after Jesus's death, the book of Matthew is written. At least that's what scholars have come to believe. So it's not as good as 4 years, but it's sure a lot better than 400 years. Okay, is the first time there's like a documented, here's what happened, here's what I saw from Matthew. Now, Mark, which if you remember is a secondary testimony, and it's really the Gospel of Peter, as I think about it. Mark was written between 55 AD. Some scholars place it as early as 55 AD, and some as late as 75 AD, but most scholars place it around 65 AD. So even before Matthew is where most scholars place the book of Mark. Now, the book of Luke is believed to be the earliest written gospel, which was written between 61 and 63 AD. And this is so important, right? Because this is one lifespan. This is like one, it's not a story that's passed from generation to generation to generation to generation, and then someone thinks to write it down. It is someone who saw it with their own eyes, or it's somebody who was alive when Jesus was alive. And even though they're not writing what they saw with their own eyes necessarily, they're writing what somebody saw with their own eyes, and they were alive at the same time together. So that's important, right? And so that's Luke. Now, the Gospel of John is kind of interesting because John was one of Jesus's inner three, but it's believed to have been the latest written of all the Gospels. So the first century bishop, the Clement of Rome, testified that John's gospel was written after the other gospels. So there's a book called the Eusebius's History of the Church, book 4, chapter 14.7, and Irenaeus, the ancient bishop of Lugdunum, he also affirmed this to be the case. And there's a book called a series or something called Against Heresies, Book 3, Chapter 1. And then later on, there's other church fathers like Jerome, and I mentioned Eusebius and Origen, O-R-I-G-E-N. They all repeated this claim. So it's kind of, again, widely held that John, the Gospel of John, even though John was the closest to Jesus, his gospel was written later. And a couple of things to know about John's gospel. First of all, John's gospel focuses more on the deity of Christ. So meaning like the spiritual aspects of Jesus. It also has lots of historical details, but it tends to be more around, almost like Jesus's philosophies and the spiritual workings and things like that. And it's probably because John was alive when the other gospels were written. And so John probably had them or had seen them. And so he was aware that those had already been documented. And so he was likely coming back and sort of filling in the gaps, saying, oh, here's some other significant stories or some other significant events that happened that haven't been fully documented or documented, at least, that were significant, at least according to John. So the Gospel of John, in terms of dating it, so there's nothing in the Gospel of John that refers to the destruction of Jerusalem, which is a very significant and well-documented historical event that if it had taken place, he likely would have referenced it. At least that's what scholars believe. And that happened in AD 70, okay, or 70 AD. And so he probably wrote it before that. And in John 21, verses 20 through 23, John appears to be aware of the fact that Peter was already dead. And we know that Peter died around 64 AD. So this dates the writing of the Gospel of John to likely be around 64 to 70 AD is probably when it was originally written. Now, remember what I referenced earlier, as I said, the earliest recovery of any New Testament of manuscript is from a manuscript that was written in 125 AD, and that is five verses from John 18. So that also sort of lines up with the timeline that this was written between 64 AD and 70 AD, and then there were a few copies of it made, and it started to propagate, and it made its way all the way to Egypt and was buried in Egypt and in 125 AD, and then we discover it years later, and then in 1934, C.H. Roberts, this British scholar, finds this a whole group of papyrus fragments and realizes and figures out that it's a part of the Gospel of John. So when you compare these Gospels to other ancient manuscripts that are considered historically accurate, there's quite a lot. I mean, you could say a preponderance of evidence that these are at least as accurate and likely exponentially more accurate than several others, both because of the number of copies. Remember, I said there's been 5,000 copies of New Testament, of early New Testament manuscripts that have been recovered, 5,000, whereas some of the other ones, the Jewish War, and you know, had nine, and then like Homer's Iliad is like 650. So it's both because the number of copies that have been recovered and because of the short time distance that transpired between when the events happened and when they were first documented, which was like 75 years at the most. We actually believe that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were all written before 70 AD, and Jesus died in 33 AD. So that timeline means that within, like, pretty solidly within 40 years, there were at least four either direct eyewitness or secondary eyewitness accounts of the life of Jesus and all these things that happened. That's pretty fast, right? I mean, that's, think about like, here's a good example, okay, that you would be a more modern day parallel, okay, is you go, you know, the life of Steve Jobs, right? So Steve Jobs died in 2011, so he was 56 years old, right? So if Steve Jobs died in 2011 and he's 56, somebody who would have been could have been alive when Steve Jobs was around, let's say they were like, maybe they are 20 years old when Steve Jobs died, okay? But they might later in life say, I want to go back and write a biography of the life of Steve Jobs. They could do years of that research, and then maybe 40 years later, which would be like 2050, they release a biography of Steve Jobs. And even though 40 years has passed, that doesn't mean that it's likely for 40 years of legend to transpire, because it's still one lifetime. It's not something being passed down from generation to generation to generation. In fact, it would have given the author, so let's say it was me, that 40 years from now, I'd be 80 something. I would have had years to verify and corroborate. I could have interviewed several people who knew Steve Jobs. I probably could have gotten a hold of some of his personal belongings. I could have heard stories. There would be other things that had been written about Steve Jobs that I could reference to as a part of pulling together my sort of masterpiece biography of Steve Jobs 40 years later. That's kind of like what's going on here. So just to give you like a frame of reference, but that's still one lifetime compared to some of these others. I mean, the Annals of Imperial Rome by Tacitus, it's 734 years went by before somebody like wrote it down, or at least before a copy has been recovered. And compare this to other religions, all right? So what we've done so far is we've looked at other historical documents, and then we've also looked at several parts of the New Testament. But if you just look at the ancient, if you look at the religious writings of other religions that have founded, and you go, let's compare the documentation of Christianity side by side with some of the other major religions, I want to do that now. So there's a writing called the Gathas of Zoroaster, and this is a Zoroastrianism, which is one of the major world religions kind of old, I guess. This, the date that he lived was 600 BC. The first biography wasn't written until AD 300. So 900 years passed in that account. There was another one on Zoroaster. So this was also for part of the founding of Zoroastrianism, which was written by Parsi. I guess so. Parsi wrote a biography of Zoroaster, which is even more popular. So Zoroaster apparently lived around 600 BC. And then this biography was written in AD 1278. So that's about 1900 years that passed between when the person lived and when the biography was written. So that's 1900 years. In Buddhism, okay, so the scriptures of Buddha, so Buddha lives around that time, 600 BC. The first biography is written in AD 100. So 700 years between when Buddha lives and when the biography is written, 700 years. And then in Islam, okay, so the sayings of Muhammad, which are in the Quran. So this is, he lived in AD, it seems like historians peg this between AD 570 and AD 632. And then the first biography is written around AD 767. So that one's much shorter. So those are both AD, right? So you've got Muhammad living between 570 and 632. And that the biography comes out in 767. So only 135 years passed there. But still, even the life of Muhammad is documented 135 years after his death. And so you've got, that's almost three times, or that's more than three times longer than the amount of time that passed between the death of Jesus of Nazareth and the gospels being recorded of his life. And not just one, but multiple gospel accounts. And in the case of like Zoroaster, I mean, in Buddha, it's 700 years that passed. And in Zoroaster's case, it's 900 to 1900 years that have passed. So just again, the historical elements here stand up to a lot of academic scrutiny. The fact that these gospels were written close to Jesus's death, it doesn't prove that Jesus is the Son of God, but it does prove that the likelihood for things to be distorted is much, much, much less, exponentially less than other ancient documents and other world religions from a purely factual basis and standpoint. So that's something to keep in mind. How do we know that Jesus was real, right? These are all of these, I'm just laying out the facts here that I've discovered. I'm still just trying to answer the question, how do we know that Jesus was real? And there's a lot. Now, another question, this plagued me for a while, was how do we know that what was originally written was preserved through the ages and not modified? So we know that there's lots of copies of what was written, and we know that it was written close to the time that Jesus was alive. And so those are good things. But just because the original could have been accurate, how do we know it didn't get diluted or changed? Kind of like a game of telephone, right? I've always wondered about this. I said, well, geez, like, if Jesus was around 2,000 years ago, how do I know that what I'm hearing about Jesus today is the same thing of what happened 2,000 years ago? And this is important. And part of what I would say up front is, if you're listening to someone, you don't necessarily know that. So that's why I mentioned earlier, I think you should read the Bible. Like, don't learn about Christianity from Christians. Learn about Christianity from reading the Bible, the documentation of the life of Christ and the people who lived. Listen to them. They were there, right? Now, hopefully you continue to listen to me at least a little bit, you know, if this is being useful for you. But even so, I would say the Bible should take precedence and superiority over anything that I'm telling you. It was written by people who were there. Plus, it's the inspired word of God. But even if you don't believe in that, just go, if there's something in the Bible that contradicts with something I'm saying, go with what is in the Bible. It's been around longer. Okay. But so how do we know that it didn't get distorted? The message didn't get distorted. Well, one of the reasons why is simply because it's written. So it's less like a game of telephone where you're whispering in someone's ear and things get distorted and you can't hear. And maybe you're not even allowed to ask, can you say that again? Right. That's sometimes the rules of telephone. But it's more like if you had a piece of paper with a writing on it and you passed it down the line, there's a pretty good chance that the person at the end of the line, they're getting the exact same piece of paper as the person who started. Or that's probably a little less accurate of a parallel. But if I was the start of the telephone line and I wrote something on a piece of paper and I handed it to you, and then you had to rewrite it, you had to try to copy what I gave you on your own paper, and then you gave it to the next person, and they gave it to the next person, and they gave it to the next person. That's a more accurate, I think, kind of parallel here. But again, if it was written and you had a chance to look at it and you could copy it and you had as much time as you needed to do that, there wouldn't be that many discrepancies. Now, there could be some over thousands of years. And guess what? I'm going to share this with you. You may not know this. There actually are a few discrepancies in the Bible. And, you know, at first, this threw me a little bit because I was like, whoa, wait a minute. I thought this was the source of truth. I thought this was like, I'm banking my eternity here on this, man. Like, now you're telling me that there's discrepancies. Well, there are a few and they're very, very minor, but there are some. And I want to point them out here, just again, in the spirit of transparency and objectivity. Now, the modern New Testament as it exists today is 99.5% free of textual discrepancies. So I want to say that up front. It's very, very, very reliable. But there are some. And actually, if you read the Bible, many Bibles actually notate where the discrepancies are. Now, what are the discrepancies? I'll give you an example. Usually they're discrepancies about exactly like what word was supposed to be used. So I'll give you an example. In Colossians chapter 1, verse 21, okay, this is an example of one. Colossians chapter 1, verse 21, some versions say, once you were alienated from God and were enemies in your minds because of your evil behavior. So of your evil behavior. But other versions say, once you were alienated from God and were enemies in your minds as shown by your evil behavior, right? So that's an example of a textual discrepancy, meaning different versions as they've been translated over the years. One says of, one says as shown by. Another example is that in Matthew 24, 36, it says, no one knows about the day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, comma, but only the Father. Other manuscripts in Matthew 24, 36 will say, no one knows about the day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, period, but only the Father. Okay, so some of them have a comma and some of them have a period. And so while these are technically textual discrepancies, and some people will try to point to those kinds of things to say, well, the Bible can't be trusted. There's textual discrepancies, you know, amongst the different copies. As you can see, they technically are textual discrepancies, but they're quite insignificant to the big picture and the whole story. So I actually think it's important to acknowledge that they are there. In fact, my Bible actually footnotes them and says when they are there, several of them. So I think it's important to acknowledge it. I also think it's just like I think it's wise to acknowledge it. It's also not wise to throw out everything because of a mistranslation of a word or a comma. In fact, it certainly doesn't open up a case about any major elements or any type of case to be made about that the overall storyline should be thrown out or that it can't be believed. They're very, very minor things. But in my opinion, having some textual discrepancies like this is actually edifying to the accuracy of the bigger picture. Because what that points to for me, as I have processed this logically and rationally, is to go, it points to the fact that this writing wasn't planned, even though the stories corroborate one another because they're the same events from different people's perspectives. No one sat down and hatched some grand plan to say, okay, you write this, you write this, you write this, and you write that. Because if they did, you likely wouldn't have those, right? So what it means is that people weren't put under some type of a controlled environment where every minuscule detail was managed and manufactured, as if you might do if you're trying to formulate something fake. It means that people were copying stuff, and it's a lot to copy. And you know, these are not the days of printing presses, and you don't just like have AI or push a button on your printer that says print. These people are having to hand write all of this stuff. So I mean, think about it yourself, like just logically for a second, because this was a big deal for me, this whole telephone thing. I struggled with this for a while. But if you just sit back and process this for a minute, if you had no time limit, how accurately do you think you could recopy a book by hand? Like, let's say you took Take the Stairs, just one of my books since we've already mentioned it. If I gave you the assignment, you know, and you were paid to do it and say, you need to take this book and you need to recopy it by hand, and there's no time limit, how accurately do you think you could recopy the book? My guess is, chances are, pretty freaking accurately, right? Like, you could probably be pretty stinking accurately, but that doesn't mean you would be free 100% of mistakes. What are the mistakes that you might actually make? I mean, first of all, maybe a spelling error, right? You overlook a letter. Maybe you skip over a word, something like that, and you get tired and your eyes go cross and you skip over a word. And by the way, this happens, or you change a word. So there's one of these in the Bible, so I'll point it out to you. So in Mark 14:30, it says that Peter will disown Jesus three times before the rooster will crow twice. Okay. So it says, you will disown me three times before the rooster will crow twice. And then there is a note that some Aramaic manuscripts do not have the word twice. And so some do and some don't. And Matthew 26, 34 is the same account without the word twice. So even inside of the gospel, there's like one of them, the word twice is there. The other one, the word twice is not there. So if you're sitting there copying, sure, I would buy that, right? Or occasionally, you know, you could get mixed up and you could leave out a section, right? You might skip over it, you know, you might just skip over a paragraph, right? Or maybe you turn a page and a page is stuck together and you miss like a chunk, something like that. You wouldn't miss like an entire chapter. You would notice that. But if like maybe a page is stuck together and you turn it fast and you're not paying attention, that kind of thing could happen. And occasionally you leave out a small section. And sometimes that could potentially be an explanation. So for example, in John chapter 7, verse 53 through John chapter 8, verse 11, so it's a longer section here, there is a story of an adulteress who is caught in the act. And this is the whole he who is without sin cast the first stone story, very famous story. And that section, there's a footnote in many Bibles, and in my Bible it says this, is that some of the earliest manuscripts don't have that section. They don't have that story. So there's some debate on that very short piece, right? It's just like a chunk. It's like a story. There's some debate on with scholars about whether or not it was added later or if it is in the right place. Like maybe it was meant to be somewhere else and somehow like a page got ripped out and it got moved somewhere. Or maybe it was added later, like after the original gospels were written. And then maybe John came back through and said, oh, hey, there's this really important story that we got to put in there. So there's some question around that, right? And you go, it's not 100% perfect. And to me, I go, that's actually, at first I used to go, well, that's kind of like, it used to shake me a little bit because I was like, man, like I got my whole eternity, you know, riding on this thing and like, they can't get the punctuation proper, you know, like, but actually over time, it's actually been the opposite. I've really settled into going, that makes so much more sense because it's real. It's human. It's not manufactured. It makes sense that would happen. Here's another example because there's language translations, right? So let's say I gave you my book in Spanish and your job was to translate it to English. Okay. So Take the Stairs is available in, I think, like 14 different languages. Okay. So this is a pretty good parallel. So let's say you got the book in Spanish, and let's pretend you spoke Spanish if you don't, and your job, you were paid to translate it to English. And then somebody else down the street also spoke Spanish, and they also got the book, and they had the same job to translate it into English. It's possible and reasonable to accept, at least for me, that two people would translate a sentence a little bit differently between languages, right? So these original manuscripts were written in Greek. And this is exactly what we see as they've been translated to other languages like English. So in some cases, even if you translate the words perfectly, the context is slightly altered or adjusted. So here's a good example. So in Mark chapter 8, verse 8, Jesus feeds 4,000 people. This is one of the miracles he performs. And then it says, afterward, the disciples picked up 7 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. Okay. So in Greek, that word basketfuls is referring to small, like a lunchbox sized basket. Okay. So in Greek, that's what that word is referring to. But that same Greek word is used in Acts chapter 9, verses 25 to describe the basket in which the Apostle Paul hides in when he escapes from Damascus, right? So it's like, it's the same word, but one is referring to a basket that is the size of a lunchbox. The other one is referring to a basket that is large enough for a grown man to get into as part of, to hide in as part of his escape. Same word, context is a little different. Something probably is off there a little bit in translation. Here's an example in Spanish. You know, I took several years of Spanish when I was in high school. And there's a word in Spanish, which is a verb, which is esperar, esperar, E-S-P-E-R-A-R, I think is how you spell it, esperar. And the word, even the word in Spanish, it has a dual meaning. It means to wait and also to hope. So, and my Spanish teacher, she used to say this, she would say, that's because when you're waiting, you're hoping, and when you're hoping, you're waiting. I always thought that was beautiful. But depending on how you use that word and the context of that word, it's the same word. And in one context, it means to wait. And in the other context, it means to hope. And the only way you know is by like the context around the word. And so some of those things happen in the translations, right? Where there's like some confusion or discrepancy or disagreement on exactly like, did it mean to wait or did it mean to hope? And those occur throughout the Bible. And I want to be forthright about sharing those with you so that you know, and you can explore them yourself. But originally, you know, that threw me, but there's no major discrepancies where it's like one Bible says Jesus is the Son of God. Another Bible says that Jesus was a woman who was from South Africa. You know, like it's not like that. They're very minor things. It's like, was it a period or was it a comma? Was it a small basket or was it a big basket? Was it of your deeds or as shown by your deeds? They're small things, but there are several of them. And that's because you're talking about thousands of years and thousands of not thousands of years, almost 2,000 years at this point, but we've had the printing press for a while. So there haven't been many discrepancies since then. So it's really hundreds of years, but thousands of copies across multiple continents and countries and people, you know, doing this. So to me, that's not something to have shakeable faith on. It's actually, to me, became very more solidifying and edifying because it made sense that if I were personally translating a book to a different language, or if I was just copying it by hand, I would make some of those same mistakes. That points to that it's organic and real and natural. So anyways, but those are a couple of the things around the historical accuracy of did Jesus exist? Before we talk about his deity, his spirituality, is he the Son of God or God incarnate? It's important to really look and digest, did he even walk the earth in the first place? And here's what I have at least concluded for myself. I mean, first of all of modern history measures the dates of the world. The timeline of the world is measured by the existence of this man, right? BC, before Christ, and AD, which people mistakenly think means after his death. It actually is a Latin phrase, which means anno domini, which means in the year of the Lord. So it is referring, you know, to the year that Jesus was born. So because Jesus died in 33 AD. So that's 33 years after he was born, or around 33 AD. So the whole world, believers and non-believers, every major religion, you know, every country, every language, all of time, and the timeline of human history is divided and measured by this man's life. And so there's just not much of an intelligent case to me that you can make that Jesus wasn't real. You also would have a really hard time disproving many of the basic facts that were documented about there was something mysterious or mystical about this man. There was something unique and unusual about his birth. There is something about a day of darkness that happened around his death that people believed in him and were willing to die for what they saw. The locations, the other people, the stories, the sights, the scenes, because of just the sheer volume of what is written about him and what is captured compared to pretty much any other ancient figure or ancient event. And with very little time passing before those things were documented, it's not really even a smart, intelligent academic argument to say that Jesus didn't exist and that there weren't some of these basic facts about his life. Now, I'm not going to go so far to say it's a fact that he was the Son of God. That part is debatable, and I think still ultimately will depend on a faith decision and a heart decision, which we'll come to later. But certainly documentation that people have questioned about whether or not this person, this man, was a deity from the beginning of time. It wasn't legend that was developed later. So almost all modern historians, both Christian and non-Christian, agree that Jesus existed. They regard his crucifixion as a historical event, right? That can be verified in secular sources. His miraculous, mystical, or divine nature is widely documented, even in secular texts. And the presence of this man radically transformed the lives of many people. People like Matthew, who went from a greedy tax collector consumed with money and security, who willingly, in one moment, in one encounter with Jesus, left it all behind to live a life of poverty and uncertainty. People like Paul, who were killing Christians, murdering them. Again, we'll talk more about this later, but he was murdering them. He went from murdering them to then completely flipping and being willing to die for saying that Jesus was the Christ and he was the Messiah. That doesn't necessarily prove that Jesus was the Messiah, but it certainly points strongly to there was something that this man existed, and there was something magnificent about this man. Whether it was fake or not, people believed to their core that they were willing to die a gruesome, torturous death in many cases. They believed that this man said who he was. And so something in his life, also his life was big enough that it became the defining moment of human history for which the entire human timeline is divided. So to me, it's a pretty strong conclusion that Jesus existed. It's well documented. There are basic facts around his life that are very strong. And so if you struggle to believe that, I can't help but say you're just uninformed, right? Which is not bad. That's fair. Like, you probably haven't spent that much time diving into this. That's why I'm putting this together for you. But I think you can confidently say he was there. And a lot of people believed these things. They weren't made up years and years later, and they didn't get distorted over time. The things that have been believed about Jesus have been believed from the beginning, from the eyewitnesses, from the people who first saw him, and the people who knew the people who knew him, and the people who could ask questions to people who knew him, and the people who could go to the places he had been. Those people believed certain things from the very beginning. So it wasn't manufactured. It wasn't made up later. You don't have to believe it was true, but what is pretty well definitely true is that the people who believed this believed it right away. It wasn't something that evolved and changed over time. So, what was it about Jesus that caused all of this to take place? What was it about him that divided the human timeline, that transformed these lives? What was it about the way that he lived that was the cause for so much documentation and writing about his life, both from secular historians and from people who were believers? What was it about him? So now we know that he existed. The question remains, was he just a good guy and a good teacher, or was he something more? And if he was something more, what evidence is there for that? That is what we'll cover next time.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Eternal Life, 7 questions every intelligent skeptic should ask about Jesus of Nazareth. As I've mentioned a few times, I'm not a pastor or leader of any religious organization of any kind. But if you are curious to get to know a bit more about me and the professional work that I do as an author, strategist, and speaker, you can head over to roryvadenblog.com. There you will get access to lots of free training resources for business people. I co-host a business podcast also with my wife and business partner, AJ, and we have a personal brand strategy firm that we run together. And I also release new free trainings every week on the psychology of growing your influence, all of which you can learn more about at roryvadenblog.com. I'll see you next time.